Live on Tape, Work in Progress, a World at Work podcast about work, life, and everything in between. With award-winning radio host Tom Alexander and Workspan's Not Safe for Work columnist Charles Epstein. Here are your hosts, Tom and Charles.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Work in Progress. My name is Tom Alexander. And as always, I am joined by my good friend and podcast partner. It is Charles Epstein. Hey, Charles.
Hey, Tom. I know that both of us are dealing with a major storm, so hopefully we can do this without any interruptions.
Or electrocution, for that matter.
Electrocution, no acts of God. So hopefully we'll be able to do this without event, just some dramatic thunder in the background, occasionally will rear its head. So just in case, letting you know that, everybody. Anyway, looking forward to today's conversation with Gregory Milano, who's the Chief Executive Officer and Managing Partner of Fortuna, a value-focused strategy consulting firm that's in the business of driving superior long-term value and total shareholder return. And we'll talk with Greg about his forthcoming journal article, Incentives Proven to Drive Shareholder Return, which, not coincidentally, is also the focus of his presentation at the Total Reward Show in Phoenix later this October. So looking forward to seeing Greg there, Tom.
Yeah, it'll be great to meet him in person. And, we're so used to these Zoom calls all the time and meeting people virtually that I got to bone up on my in-person chops. You know, it's been a while.
Yeah, no, I hear you. But speaking of incentive, that's every incentive for us to be there in Phoenix. There are obviously quite a few people who've come on who are going to be presenting at the show and other people in the next coming week. So that'll be really good. But again, looking forward to speaking with Greg today.
Yeah, really looking forward to it. Also, I should have to mention he's the author of the book Curing Corporate Short-Termism. That's something that he has written recently. So it's Gregory Milano next right here on Work in Progress. Stay tuned.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. She'll find the note I left hanging on her door.
Data. The mantra of business today. It's nothing new to World at Work. It's no small feat that they've been collecting data on salary issues for its salary budget survey for more than 45 years. Think about it. 45 years. Curious to know how your company stacks up? HR execs in the know rely on World at Work's salary budget survey. Shouldn't you too? Go to worldatwork.org/salarybudgetsurvey to learn more.
I'm gonna go fishing, that's what I do. Think about nothing, not even you. Catch me a big one, fine speckled trout.
Gregory Milano is Chief Executive Officer and Managing Partner of Fortuna, a value-focused strategy consulting firm that's in the business of driving superior long-term value and total shareholder return. Greg is author of the book Curing Corporate Short-Termism, which articulates the causes of and actionable solutions for short-termism. He is also the author of a forthcoming article, which will appear on World at Work's website. It's called Incentives Proven to Drive Shareholder Return, which is also the focus of his presentation at the Total Reward Show in Phoenix later this year in October. He joins us today from Jacksonville. Hey, Greg, how are you?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, please say hi to my podcast partner, Charles Epstein.
Hi, Charles.
Hey, Greg, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. Just a little bit of a side note. If anybody hears some thunderclaps in the background, we didn't artificially put those in for dramatic effect. It happens to be storming. What else is new down here in South Florida? So just a little bit of an editorial note. Greg, Fortuna, as in Fortuna, which I don't know is whether that's fortuitous or not, because I know that you are a fisherman. I know that having spoke with you last week in preparation for this. And I also know that last weekend you were going out and you were going to be looking for tarpon, which is a new experience for you. How did that work out, Greg?
Well, it didn't go too well, actually. I'm a new Florida resident. Just a couple of years ago, I moved down from New York, and I'm still learning about the fishing around here. And although we saw fish, we were not able to actually get any on our hooks. So it wasn't a totally successful event, but it was still a beautiful day in Florida. And as they say, a bad day fishing is still better than a great day at work.
Yes, yes. Although, full disclosure, fishing is just something I never could completely get my mind around, partly because I am just by nature very impatient, and obviously you need that to pursue. I guess it's a sport. Yes, Greg?
Yeah, absolutely.
It is a sport. And, and number two, it just always felt to me that it's something you could not necessarily get much better at, but I may be wrong.
I think you're definitely wrong.
Okay. All right. So we're getting off on a good foot. Thank you. always looking to find new things to learn. But in any case, again, thanks so much for taking the time. Really appreciate it. Tom mentioned your forthcoming article that's going to be appearing, I believe, in the World at Work Journal, and which, of course, means it'll also be on the World at Work website. And it begins as follows, quote, "The goal of executive compensation should be to motivate the right behaviors that lead to value creation for shareholders. Unfortunately, across numerous companies, the correct behaviors aren't being motivated," end quote. What would you say is the single biggest problem in executive compensation that encourages the worst behavior problems?
There are many problems, to be sure. Problems with bad measures, problems with bad targets for performance, and bad combinations of measures that provide, you know, adverse and conflicting signals. But above all, in my experience doing this sort of work over just about 30 years now, the biggest problem is the propensity to measure performance as a variance against budgeted performance. When we measure against our budgets, we're basically paying people to plan for mediocrity. We want them to try and shoot for the stars. And it turns out if we encourage them to basically plan low, in other words, so they get an easier target and maximize how much they get paid for whatever performance they actually deliver, planning for a mediocre target tends to lead to mediocrity. It's not that common that somebody plans low and then magically, you know, delivers very strong performance.
Sure.
And just one little illustration of sort of the way I think about this. You know, let's say we were measuring revenue growth. I'd rather have somebody aim for 10% growth and achieve 8% rather than somebody else who might aim for 2% growth and achieve 3%. I'd rather have 8% growth than 3% growth.
Right.
And once we start measuring against budgets, we're actually encouraging people to get the plan down as low as possible, which again tends to lead the performance down as well.
Yeah, you know, but I assume also there's sort of a Goldilocks zone. In other words, if you raise the bar too high, it may in a way be a disincentive. People may think it's just too hard, and at some point they may shut down. Is that an issue as well?
Yeah, well, I want them to aim high. I'm not saying I want to raise their bar. And the way we sort of get around this measuring against budget problem is we use a complete enough measure that when it goes up, it's good, and when it goes down, it's bad. Our mm-hmm. measure, when it's the same as last year, means management has improved profit, or EBITDA, actually, enough to cover an adequate return on what they invested during the year. And that's kind of satisfactory performance for investors. And so that's where we should get satisfactory, you know, rewards from management. And mm-hmm. if we line that up, sort of zero improvement in our measure, which is, you know, sort of acceptable performance to shareholders, with acceptable performance to managers, we can forget about budgets and now say to people, just plan to be as successful as you can be. And every sort of dollar value you create, you get a share of it. And as soon as you do that, the whole planning process just becomes dramatically more valuable and useful.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, it makes sense.
In your article, you mentioned that there are three main considerations when designing an incentive plan. Can you tell us what those are?
Yeah, the three main things that you need to do is first figure out what are you going to measure? And I'll focus on financial performance for the purposes of answering this, but of course, we want to measure non-financial performance as well. ESG metrics and so forth are quite important these days to ensure that we're providing a holistic, you know, sort of performance. But we have to decide what performance measures to use. And as I mentioned just a moment ago, we want a very complete measure so that it properly trades off growth, profitability, and the amount of investment it takes to produce that growth. If you have a really profitable business, we want people investing a real lot to grow the business. If your business isn't too profitable, we want them to be careful about how much investment and maybe focus on managing profit margins and so forth. So we want a very complete measure that encourages, wherever you are now, the right levers to be pulled to go forward. Unfortunately, most companies don't do that. They have some sort of a scorecard of a bunch of different things that they measure that don't necessarily completely, you know, capture every aspect of performance. And consequently, it's kind of like if you have a balloon and you squeeze one side of the balloon, the air just pushes the balloon out somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, if you are only measuring profit margins, you're going to wind up probably investing too much to try to jack those margins up. And maybe that's not a productive investment. So we kind of ignore that when we're only looking at profit margins. So the first challenge is to come up with the right measures. And again, we want them to be as complete as possible. The second is how performance targets are set. And as I stated previously, we want to get away from measuring against budgets or plans. We want to measure against some sort of objective standard of performance. With a very complete measure, it's last year. If we're getting better than last year, that's good. If we're getting worse than last year, that's bad. Freeing up the planning process. And then the last thing you need to do to design good incentives is to set the, what we call the bonus sensitivity, right? The sort of slope of the payout curve. If I get a little more performance, how much does that translate into in terms of additional bonus? And the right way to think about that is to look at the sort of volatility of the business. How volatile is the performance measure? And the more volatile it is, the more we want to dampen that so we don't get too much volatility in pay. If pay gets too volatile, people start to treat it like it's a lottery and they don't, you know, really feel like they have much impact. So we have to sort of calibrate that bonus sensitivity to be right. So again, the right measures, the right means of setting target performance for those measures, and then how much more or less do you get when you're above or below the target? Those are the three components you need to design a good incentive.
Yeah, and I'm sure there was an asterisk applied to this, given COVID and so forth. It would be kind of hard to go year to year and measure last year versus this year. So I'm assuming you'd have to sort of recalibrate that within the context of a broader global economy. No. Yes.
No. No, actually, we don't. Our clients didn't recalibrate. So because we're measuring performance against last year, automatically last year, you know, if you were in a typical company that suffered, right, some companies actually benefited, right? Amazon had record performance,
sure,
and some of the other e-commerce companies. But if we were in the majority of companies that actually suffered financially because of the pandemic, you would have been paid a lot less on your incentive plan because of the drop in performance. But then that new lower level becomes the base to measure improvements the next year.
I see.
And if it really is a one-off and you recover, you kind of get the money back when you prove that you can recover. And so this actually does a really good job of dealing with the short-term year-to-year volatilities, even something as big as the pandemic, by kind of just normalizing it. And what you get paid over, say, a three-year period really has to do with how you did over these 3 years, not just all the little ups and downs that happened along the way.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense. So how has Fortuna's approach to incentives been received by management, investors, proxy advisors?
Well, managements that we've worked with like it a lot because it makes it really clear how you get paid. It's no longer a game of, you know, and typically what happens in a lot of companies is if you're running one of the business units and you go to, you know, submit a plan to management, you have a list of reasons why this year is going to be a down year. And because you're trying to get your target as low as possible. And corporate has the opposite incentive. They come back with all these reasons why they think you can actually have higher performance. And it's this big negotiation that goes on and people are hiding information from each other. And it's, you know, really terrible thing. Once people implement and get used to our framework, where it's all just based on performance against last year and planning, it's just about planning. There's a lot more transparent transfer of information up and down the organization. And, you know, as I like to say, you know, if a CEO goes to a business unit head and says, hey, people have come up with these three things that we think can improve your performance. The business unit head might not agree, but before they answer the question, you know, they're going to, you know that if they do that, they're going to get paid more, right? It's not like you're trying to take money away from me. You're trying to help me make more money. And oh, by the way, it's like I'm a partner with the CEO, because if I make more money, he or she makes more money also. So, you know, it's a real alignment. And once people get used to it and understand that, they like it.
A lot more clarity.
Yeah, just tremendous clarity and transparency. The investors, to a person that I've spoken to about the system, like it a lot. One of our clients, when they implemented our framework, went out to the top 10 investors with a short presentation just to get their feedback before they actually, you know, sort of dotted the I's and crossed the T's. And they got 10 resounding, yes, we love that, that's great. And even one of them actually wound up saying that it was the best proxy they'd ever read in their life. So that was very good. And, you know, I don't want to make predictions about the proxy advisory firms, ISS and Glass Lewis, but, you know, thus far, they've been very supportive of companies that have embraced this framework. It's a very holistic view of management's contribution, again, capturing growth, margin, asset intensity, and so forth. And they like that. They mm-hmm. like the fact that you take the games away, and it's just, if you do well, you get paid more. If you do poorly, you get paid less.
Yeah.
Gregory Milano is our guest. He's Chief Executive Officer and Managing Partner of Fortuna. Greg, can a company just change incentives, or is there more to it?
I used to think if you changed incentives, people would figure out how to make more money for themselves, and in doing so, they would do good things for the company. And I still believe that's generally true. I think incentives are extremely important to getting the right behavior from a management team. But I think I understand now that you need to do more training and communication. It's really like a change management process, if you will, to get people to think and act more like owners. And that whole training and communication process can't be focused on finance. It needs to be focused on, what does this mean to me? How does it affect the decisions I'm supposed to make? And, you know, educating people on that, coaching them, and so forth. And so, you know, doing that is really important to achieving success. It's not complicated. It's just different from what they're used to. But if you don't recognize that and deal with it, people will, you know, will not necessarily embrace the behavior you're after.
Yeah. You know, I just want to ask you a question. We've had people on who talk about recognition programs and have platforms, in fact, to measure recognition, or just put out these programs where people can get recognized. Is that at all a component of your model, or is that something else? Just maybe a complementary component that could be offered by a third party?
Yeah, it's very complementary, but it is separate. Those kinds of programs tend to run in isolation, separate from the company's main incentive reward program. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's very complementary, though, because the ideas that come out of that kind of a program tend to also help, you know, our measures and shareholder value, you know, the good ideas. So getting people to be rewarded for their contributions that way is a good thing.
Yeah. You know, some aspects of your approach sound like economic value added, AKA EVA. Are they similar? And, or, you know, how is this different?
In principle, very similar. And EVA, for those who don't know, is a measure of profit minus a charge for capital. Our residual cash earnings measure is similar, except we measure cash flow instead of profit. We don't count depreciation as a cost. And when we charge for the investment in the business, we don't depreciate it away. So what you paid for the asset stays that way forever. These are, you know, probably nuances that are don't seem to be really important probably to the, you know, the typical HR or even total rewards expert, but they become really important in understanding what really drives the stock market. You know, our measure that's cash flow based is a lot like EVA, but it actually tracks total shareholder return better than EVA in every industry. And we've published that. So it's similar, but it's like an improved version of EVA, tracks share prices better, encourages more investment in the future, but holds people more accountable. They don't get the benefit of just sweating assets and letting them depreciate away. And lastly, you know, we really find that communicating EVA with all the adjustments to accounting was very hard. I worked, by the way, at Stern Stewart. I was a partner of Stern Stewart. I founded Stern Stewart Europe. It's the company that made EVA popular in the 90s. And it was more confusing. It was harder to convince people that, you know, they could affect it. And we simplified the measure a lot in addition to making it cash-based. So it's like EVA, but it's really an improved, a more modern version of it.
You talk about creating an ownership culture. What are the characteristics of an ownership culture, and how does a leadership team know when they're there, when they're in place?
So an ownership culture, I've worked with a number of owners, founder owners, some people that, you know, started their company and ran it. And there are some traits they have that are really undeniable, that are just really, really important to achieving success, we believe. For example, as you would expect, they treat the company's capital as if it was their own money. I mean, in fact, it is their own money.
Right? It is their own money.
Right. But, you know, if somebody invests, you know, $1,000 in something that turns out to only be worth $800, they've kind of destroyed $200 of value. We want some share of that to show up in the manager's incentive in a very definitive way. So they know if before they want to make an investment, that the forecast they have of the future is not just it's not something you just use to market the idea to senior management to get it approved. It's something you really have to convince yourself that you believe in. Otherwise, you're exposing your own money to a negative outcome. So getting people to treat the company's money as if it was their own money is a really important thing. Another owner trait that we try to reinforce is what we call extreme prioritization. Extreme prioritization is where you know, the people really genuinely apply the 80-20 rule, right? They recognize that 80% of the success is going to come from 20% of the activities, and they spend a lot of time culling out all those things that are really not all that important. They either delegate them to somebody else or they just stop them altogether. And one thing I've noticed, by the way, when I work with a lot of companies over the years, when I work with a private company run by the founder, the original founder, they tend to have all the time in the world for important meetings about important topics. When I work with a CEO of a public company, very often they're in so many meetings, when I want to schedule a meeting, it's you know, 4 weeks from now. And some of that comes from this extreme prioritization. It's really a very important part of figuring out where you create the most value and focusing on it and making sure it happens, even if some of the less important things kind of drop by the wayside. Just one more, we have a whole list of these, but there's one more I want to bring up because it's very important, and that is a willingness to fail. In an ownership culture, there's a willingness to experiment, try things, and if you fail, that's okay. You admit it, you learn from it, and you move on. In a lot of companies, there's such a stigma associated with failure that they could be investing in a project that for years people have known is not going to pan out, but they're afraid to admit failure. And so they just kind of move on, you know, from there. And they just keep running the project, keeping the sandbox going, so to speak, for a long time. And that's not good for anybody. It takes away money you could be putting into new good projects, and it reduces the performance level. So this willingness to fail is a really important part of trying to create value and drive success over the long term.
Now, that actually at first blush sounds a little bit counterintuitive. On the one hand, you're saying that you know, you need to have this willingness to fail, or an ownership culture promotes that kind of ethos. But on the other hand, you're putting your own money at risk. So it seems that they're sort of going in different directions. So in other words, if you're telling me I need to have a willingness to fail, I'm putting, you know, again, my own skin in the game. How do you sort of reconcile that? Or how do you promote a willingness to fail?
That's a really good and astute question, and I'm glad you asked it because it allows me to clarify it more. So in a classic sort of command and control kind of company where you're measuring against budgets and your variances against those budgets are controlled tightly, the willingness to fail goes away because you don't want to put anything in your budget you're not certain of. In an environment where you're just paid for improvement, maybe you have five good innovative ideas and each one of them only has a 30 or 40% chance of success. You're going to want to do them all, you know, knowing that if you achieve 30 or 40% of them, the sort of probability weighted outcome is, you know, you're going to make a lot of money. But you wouldn't do that in this sort of command and control environment. So there's two things that are important to encouraging this willingness to fail. One is having a symmetry of upside and downside in the reward program. Not just downside if you fail, but upside if you win. And then the other is this idea of measuring against last year so that, you know, if you tell me that this investment is going to cause me to make a little bit less money this year, let's say I'm going to make $10,000 less this year, but But if I'm right about my forecast, I'm going to make $20,000, $30,000 over the next few years. That's a good return on my personal investment. I'm going to be more willing to take that risk if I believe in the outcome. And in a company where each year is measured against the budget, you get whacked this year, that's a technical HR term, when you don't perform, you know, when the performance goes down, and then all the benefits next year just get rolled into the budget, so you never get the upside. So, you know, this idea of promoting a willingness to fail while having this, you know, sort of real accountability for continuous improvement actually goes together very well.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Greg, we really do appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to come on.
And I just want to say one last thing, Greg. You will be at the Total Reward Show in October in Phoenix. Tom and I will be there. So looking forward to seeing you.
Looking forward to it as well. I'm going to be talking about how incentives affect behavior, and I think it's going to be a great talk.
Yeah, I think this tees that up very nicely. And I think you left quite enough out there that we didn't discuss to get people to the presentation. So thanks.
Gregory Milano is Chief Executive Officer and Managing Partner of Fortuna, a value-focused strategy consulting firm that's in the business of driving superior long-term value and total shareholder return. He's also the author of the book, Curing Corporate Short-Termism. Gregory Milano spoke to us today from Jacksonville, Florida. This is Work in Progress. Back in a moment.
Data, the mantra of business today. It's nothing new to World at Work. It's no small feat that they've been collecting data on salary issues for its salary budget survey for more than 45 years. Think about it, 45 years. Curious to know how your company stacks up? HR execs in the know rely on World at Work's salary budget survey. Shouldn't you too? Go to worldatwork.org/salarybudgetsurvey to learn more.
Wrapping things up now on Work in Progress along with Charles Epstein. I am Tom Alexander. And Charles, Gregory Milano, Chief Executive Officer, Managing Partner at Fortuna. Interesting stuff. And we get to see him in person in October.
Yeah, indeed. Incentives and motivation, such a great topic. And as he got into in some depth, just shows you how much goes into it. It's much more than compensation.
Yeah.
And devising a model and calibrating that model is, you know, it's very, very subtle stuff. So, and again, very involved. So enjoyed that conversation very much. And can I share with you, Tom, my favorite story vis-a-vis motivation?
Please do. I'm all ears.
Hey, okay. I know this is going to speak to you because it is a film anecdote. The Peter Bogdanovich, who as many people know, certainly you know, was a film reviewer and writer before he became director. And he was interviewing Lee Marvin, and he was talking about his role in John Ford's classic, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. And as you remember, the first time you see Lee Marvin in this movie, he accosts, if you will, the stagecoach coming into town with Jimmy Stewart and others. He was coming from, you know, D.C. to come back, great homecoming. And they robbed the stagecoach, does Lee Marvin and his gang. At one point, he absolutely, in the most vicious way imaginable, bullwhips Jimmy Stewart, takes great malicious, malevolent glee in bullwhipping Jimmy Stewart. Mm-hmm. So Peter Bogdanovich in interviewing says, you know, I've never seen such ferocity captured on celluloid before, Lee. What was your motivation for that?
Uh-huh.
Thursday. What do you mean Thursday? Payday. It's the day we got paid. Oh, okay. Thanks, Lee.
Wow.
I cleared it up.
Yeah. Didn't mince words, did he?
Didn't mince words.
No.
You know?
No.
So, yeah, I thought that was that was great. But
geez, Lee, you really bullwhipped me there.
Yeah. Well, by the way, I hate to break it to you, but I can tell you hadn't broken out that Jimmy Stewart in quite a while, because it kind of veered into your Sean Connery a little bit.
It did. I have to admit.
Yeah, it was like a Jimmy Connery or Jimmy Stewart in kilts.
Yeah.
But nice try. Nice try.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, you showed some nerve, you dusted it off and broke it out. So
yeah, well, it's
I got to give
while.
It to you, man. It goes to Greg talking about the willingness to fail. Nobody embraces the willingness to fail like you, Tom.
No, I really listen, you know, Born to Fail, I think is pretty much that's the title of my new book.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, the inertia of disappointment, which was my first book.
Yes. That was a great page turner, or whatever the opposite of page turner is.
Yeah, right.
but I should also say, you know, just as is the case with many of our conversations after we hit the record button, we had a really interesting conversation with Greg on behavioral economics and how some of that thinking, how some of that work factors into their model and the work that they do. So, here's wishing that Greg has better luck when he gets back out there. Hopefully the fish are going to be biting this coming weekend and the weekends to come. But I really enjoyed speaking with Greg. It was a fascinating conversation on a really interesting topic.
Yeah, very much so enjoyed it. Thanks to Gregory Milano. And we will be back again next week with a brand new show. For Charles Epstein, I'm Tom Alexander. Thanks for listening to Work in Progress. So long, everybody.
This has been Work in Progress, a World at Work podcast about work, life, and everything in between, with award-winning radio host Tom Alexander and Workspan's Not Safe for Work columnist Charles Epstein. For more, visit worldatwork.org/work in progress. That's worldatwork.org/work in progress. Join us next week for another edition of Work in Progress.